Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast with Sports Pro editor Owen Connolly, getting inside the sports industry and recording it on audio.
Ho, 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 everyone, and welcome to our Christmas special of the Sports Pro Podcast. With me, as ever, is Sports Pro Deputy Editor Adam Nelson. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Owen. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Adam. Merry Christmas to you, unofficial partner Richard Gillis.
Merry Christmas to you and all the listeners out there.
Thanks, Richard. And Merry Christmas to pod newcomer Tarek Panja from Bloomberg. Hi, Tarek.
Merry Christmas. Hello.
So, guys, 2016, almost done. It's been great, hasn't it? It's a year that we'll remember for the rest of our lives, our very short, chaotic and painful lives. Richard Gillis, any highlights you'd like to pick out?
Yep.
Oh.
I have got a load of highlights, actually, and I've gone to the expense of writing them down. So here we are. My highlights, so Euro Championships, Euro 2016, I thought I was there quite a bit. Thought it was really good, really sort of well run, and came at a good time. Good news stories, Iceland and Wales, and you know the stuff on the pitch I thought was entertaining to a large degree if you took England out of that. And I thought it was great. I thought that on a personal note, I was a few weeks beforehand, someone prominent in the sports business of Britain, rang me up and said, can you come to Paris and interview Pelé for, you know, some sort of sponsored thing? I said, fantastic, okay, I'm going to do that. And anyway, a week later, I got the call from the same person who then said, so Pelé can't make it, and can we do a raffle and a quiz instead? So that was my personal highlight around Euro 26. So that's what I was doing, behind the scenes, making things work.
Pelé can't make it, also how you got booked on this podcast.
Pelé can't make it, I think, is just, you know, normally it's Rob Bonnett can't make it, is the phone call I get. So, you know, we've got a conference tomorrow, Rob Bonnett can't make it, what are you doing? And by the way, I'm always free. I think, so that Euro, the whole thing, I thought was great. Another, my favourite story was Pat Hickey and his pants in Rio. I thought they're just so, my ex, and that's sort of almost emblematic of 2016 for me.
We need to tread carefully here. Was it his pants or was it his dressing gown?
I think he wasn't wearing anything. It was later a dressing gown.
That's the image that we all wanted to take with us into Christmas.
It was like a sort of, it just summed up everything. And I've sort of, my former colleagues on the Irish Times had enormous fun with it, you know, but also it was obviously a serious story at the heart of it, but it just seemed to sum up so much of what people think about, you know, the Olympics and the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So it was like one of those great stories that were just sort of, it went from the back pages to the front pages. Obviously in Ireland it was enormous news. It's just like there was the sport always rescues the sports business sometimes, you know. It's like one of those, we always talk about the Olympics and, you know, once it gets going, it's fantastic, but we have ages and ages, and obviously Tarek can just talk about this forever, but it's like that whole summer of sport, the actual sport, I thought was really good. It's just there's so much going on around the outside, which is our bread and butter, but it's great that, you know, you remember that actually it's just brilliant, you know, most of the time on the pitch, which is good.
Tarek, that leads us nicely into, I suppose, the story that's shaped the last few years for you, which is Rio 2016 and the business of all of that, which came to a predictably messy head, but somehow, as Richard said, they managed to pull it off in their way in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of as predictably sort of seeing these reviews, obviously here in newspapers in Brazil and here as well. They did it well. They did it as far as the TV was concerned, right? I mean, Usain Bolt, Simone Biles, Mo Farah, Neymar, all these guys showed up. They won their events. They gave us some great memories. And it kind of looked good on TV. You had the few weird, wacky moments like the green diving pool, because someone poured in, like, I don't know, 70 times too much of something into the pool. You know, the Olympics deliver stories as well as journalists. We had the Ryan Lochte story. It was remarkable. I mean, it was a perfect story for for like news hounds at the Olympics. I mean, it was such a remarkable story because he'd and it meant so much to Brazil as well, because the thing with Brazilians, in my time there, they're really conscious of what foreigners think of them. So we can complain about our country, but please don't. Please just don't make us look bad. And you've got this guy, a very famous dude, who went on TV, said he was held at gunpoint or a gun to his head, and he was a hero and his mates were sort of cowards, etc. And then, you know, flew away. And then, you know, from the president's office down, everyone was panicked. This was like the worst possible thing that could happen, and the whole story unravelled in the most remarkable way.
And just the kind of laziest Brazilian, you know, scare story stereotypes as well.
Stereotypes, absolutely, yeah.
And obviously the whole point of doing major events is to sell a different story of Brazil, and, you know, it's one that we, again, lapse into cliché. All of the, well, I say all, a lot of the media coverage, but also a lot of the sponsor activations are all on, you know, it's beaches, it's parties, this is a great place to have a party, and the message they're trying to get across is actually this is a proper country with grown-up, you know, event hosting facilities, and we, you know, there's a business here, and that all that Lochte story just was one of you know, just I thought it was terrible. I thought the whole thing, and I really hope he doesn't recover from it in a way. You know, he's a sort of entitled sort of
brat, right?
Brat, yeah. And I'm, you know, I sometimes these people come back and they sort of come dry. I know he was doing ice dancing or whatever he was doing, but it was such a sort of horrible story and so important, and impacted on people in a tangible way who just didn't need it. I was, it was quite shocking actually, and I really, really hope that the sponsor, sort of community don't say, oh, well, you know, let's reinvent him or let's try and, you know, create another persona for him.
Well, they've tried, but the calibre of sponsor that he's been attracting, with all due respect, is not of the kind of Ralph Lauren and Speedo kind of line that he was involved with before. But, yeah, it's true, and fair play to everyone involved in debunking that story and kind of turning it around quite quickly. Tarek, you were back in Brazil a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
What's the feeling on the ground? Obviously, the political story has evolved further since then, and, you know, it's not going away. This is a generational thing now for Brazil. But what's the feeling on the ground about the aftermath of the Olympics and the effect that it's had on people?
It kind of depends on who you ask. But, again, you know, in terms of 2016, it is the most... The Olympics took place, you know, against a backdrop of the most remarkable political collapse. You know, it's been... You can imagine the president going, the House Speaker being arrested, politicians all over the country being arrested and sent to jail. In a way, that sends a really good message in a sense that, look, finally, this sort of culture of impunity, bribe-taking, etc., is not going to be accepted. But this was the backdrop to the Olympics, plus the worst recession in decades. So they did pull it off, and they did do it. But the question, I suppose, going back is... Should they have hosted it? Country spending, I don't know, north of $15 billion on this sporting event. There is some infrastructure that is going to be used in the future. It might be useful to Rio for sure, like a new road, new rail, etc. But would they have been building these things going towards Olympic Park or elsewhere? That's something we're just not going to know.
Yeah.
But should these countries be hosting these events? Should they be that expensive? That's one of the things. Now, going back now, just 2 weeks ago, one of the great legacies, as far as the tourists are concerned, is a new underground road extension, which cuts the traffic from the airport in half or to another side of the city. So if you're wealthy and can afford it and live in the south zone of Rio, yeah, your life's pretty great. You've got four new metro stops. You've got the extension to Barra, where the Olympics were, etc. And you've still got the glow of being able to go to these games, which were just a few months ago. You know, if you're everyone else, have you seen much in the way of improvement? Probably not. Not really. That money is gone now. Security concerns are high. The pacification program in the favela seems to have failed. So crime rates are high. There's been tit for tat killings between the police and the traffickers again. You know, is that how it was supposed to be after all this spending. I don't know, you know.
A lot of those stories are much bigger than the Olympics, but that is something that we've discussed on this podcast before, is, you know, the kind of requirements that an Olympic Games has, and also the kind of statement that it makes about what a city should be prioritising.
And I agree with that, what the last thing you just said, but the other bit, you know, and we all wrestle with this thing about the, you know, the impact of large events in countries that, you know, ostensibly can't afford them. I've come back to the idea that I like to think that actually the infrastructural changes are probably the Olympics' greatest argument in terms of pushing it. You know, it is a moment in which it gives politicians a deadline and a reason to push through major infrastructural change, which is really, really difficult to do without it, because, you know, it's just there's never the right time, and we're seeing that with, you know, in the UK with train lines and various things. And I just think the Olympics actually, that's the one area where I think legacy, the dreaded L word, does have an impact.
Mm. The question would be...
And the other, the other bit to it is actually there is always a shopping list of benefits to an Olympics that are attached, which are impossible for it to fulfil. So it's a tricky one, and you know, again, we've talked about it a lot in the past, but it's interesting because obviously you've been there and lived there for that period of time and through that period.
Yeah, definitely, there's definitely no question, shadow of question, that spending would not have happened without the Olympics, be it in Rio or London as well, not just the developing world. Question is it the right spending? You're going to have this stuff done to a deadline to take, in case of Rio, people from one part of town to where the Olympic Park is. Is that the right way to spend all that infrastructure cash on a very complicated city that has lots of issues? And this week, in fact, one of the big legacy promises, the one that caught the eye as well, and it would have benefited kind of everyone, really, was cleaning up the bay, this bay where the sailing was. Stunning location, probably the best we're ever going to see during the Olympics, I'd say, you know, with the Sugarloaf Mountain in the background, etc. You know, it's full of fecal matter. Basically, everyone's whatever you do in the morning is ending up in the bay there, untreated. Now you got poor kids swimming in this stuff, and it was you know, a cesspit really for disease. Now the Olympics was the great event that could help start a cleaning program then, and sort of absolutely make this the pristine location that it deserves to be. So that was the promise, and it was not met at all. They just announced last week that they've just stopped all cleaning projects there because they've run out of money. Mm. Now, that's really sad, because that would have been a really good Olympic legacy, because it was part of the Olympic programme.
Speaking to the local organising committee before the event, you talk about priorities, and their priority became how do we keep the competition area as clean as we can, and that wasn't really the area that necessarily needed addressing.
No, absolutely. I mean, that was an interesting issue in itself. I don't profess to be an expert on sailing at all, but talking to those guys, you know, in terms of the damage to a competition that big debris can do is quite significant. It just ruined someone's race, so they had to make sure they can get from one end to the other and then, you know, move on. And some of the stuff that they found in there, you know, there was sofa, TV. I mean, someone's dog, you know, it was quite awful, really. Like a dog on a lead was found in there, etc. You know, it was pretty grim. Now you can imagine that sort of emerging during Olympic competition to billions of people around the world. That would have been a real horror show. So, you know, for the competition, they sorted that out. Yeah. The other big issue, I guess, and this is where, you know, I think IOC, FIFA, given the World Cup, needed to do a bit more than just sort of say, you know, we rely on the government, you know, we can't do any more than this, is the issue of corruption. It's their project. They've handed this, the keys to these cities or these countries. It's their banner, it's the IOC rings or the FIFA sign, etc. Mm. So we've just seen a report in Brazil by the National Audit Office that 5 of the 8 stadiums used for the Football World Cup have been subject to millions of dollars in bribes being paid.
Yeah.
So people have got rich off the back of these events who shouldn't have in this case. We haven't heard anything concrete about the Olympics, but I don't know, history shows that. Give it time and we'll probably be reading about that in a year or so, no doubt.
I mean, big movements of money, I guess, has been the other theme of the industry this year. And Adam, I wanted to bring you in at this point just to talk about, I guess, investment in the sports industry and through the sports industry and, you know, new centres of power emerging.
Yes, it has. And when we sat down this time last year to do the Christmas podcast, we probably spoke a lot about the influx of Chinese money coming into European sport and the money that they were spending to bring sport into China. And that has continued apace throughout 2016. And will probably continue to do so into 2017. We spoke on last week's podcast, when it was 2 weeks ago, about the displays of soft power that sport brings, spending in Russia and in China. And I guess that follows on from the Rio story. Brazil, when it won the Olympics, wanted to use that as a display of soft power. It wanted to show that it was an emerging force in the world through this huge sporting event. Sadly, the financial collapse of 2007 and 2008 kind of stopped that from happening in a way, and then the political turmoil that you were talking about sort of ruined that whole project. But yeah, you know, money is always going to trump everything else in sport, and it has continued to do so this year.
And we're beginning to see as well, again, something that we've made reference to before, but movements of money that happened maybe 10 years ago, if you're looking at Russia and at Qatar, you're beginning to feel the influence now that money has bought, not just in sport, but beyond that. I mean, what do we think the upshot of this big Chinese project is? I mean, it's the scale is different from last year, I think, and different possibly from what people imagined it was going to be.
Yeah, this it's unprecedented, really, isn't it? I mean, we're sat here, and we could be sat in a different pub where David Cameron took President Xi. Next thing you know, they bought the pub. So, you know, everything is up for grabs, and suddenly there's this surge of spending on real estate, on entertainment, and within entertainment is sport, and within sport is football. And where's it going to end? We don't know, you know. We absolutely don't know. We've got to think about all the infrastructure around the sport that's being bought. It's not just the great back page leads for The Sun, you know, £500,000 a week, Alexis Sanchez or whatever. We've got media companies. We had MP and Silver, was it this year? We've got Jester Fucci, the George Mendes agency, also is partly in Chinese hands. You know, European football teams, the Milan derby next year is more or less going to be a Chinese derby. And then you've got Birmingham v Wolves as well. It's also going to be a Chinese event. I think what we need to get to understand is the size of China. And that middle class is pretty significant, and they want something to spend their money on, and they can afford it.
And possibly as well with the Chinese economy slowing just ever so slightly, kind of we're talking about GDP going up 7% instead of 8%, which is, you know, not really levels that we can comprehend in Europe just at this moment. But maybe they're sensing that the time is now to, you know, to launch a concerted period of investment overseas. Again, utilizing
there's another interesting aspect here. Like China, obviously, getting money out of China is not that easy. It's not like we're just going to... It took, in the case of football, Xi Jinping said we want to be good at football or something, you know. Getting money out of China is probably... people who've got money is not a bad idea, because you want to, in case it all goes wrong, which we've seen with Russia, we've seen with other countries. I mean, look, we're sitting in London, more than half of this city's sort of sitting parked on foreign money somewhere that has been taken out one place and put here. It's almost as a sort of a safety net for some of the people who have this cash to have their money in a safe place like the UK, for example. So it's not only about, you know, football or you know, entertainment or anything. You know, there is also this safety issue for wealthy people. And I think London's always been a safe haven, hasn't it, really?
There's an interesting dynamic to this where it relates to sport and entertainment. And that's these now rising centres of influence that are coming out of California and out of China, in that Wanda have gone out and they've bought up, you know, huge numbers of properties, and they've also gone out and bought film studios in Hollywood and so on. And WME IMG are doing more or less the same thing from the West. They've bought UFC. You know, they already have enormous amount of influence in Hollywood and enormous cultural influence throughout the English-speaking world. Are we getting to a point where, you know, we're going to start seeing sport on a different level again?
I think so. I think the Chinese attack on soccer so far has been two-pronged, and they've been spending a lot of money to bring European and South American players into China, and they've also been spending money on clubs in Europe. And I think, you know, we talk about the GDP slowing and we talk about them wanting to get money out of China. I think what's going to happen is that's going to have to be focused on either or at some point. And I think what will happen is that they'll end up outsourcing their Chinese league. We hear a lot about European Super League happening. I think Chinese investment in European football is only going to encourage that to happen at some point. I'm not saying short term, but further down the line, if Chinese ownership ends up being involved in several of the top European clubs, they're going to want to see that in a position where they're all regularly playing each other in a different format than what the Champions League offers.
It's a dream of wonder, isn't it?
I mean, exactly.
That we already have that. They're already unsettled, the European clubs in UEFA enough. Just before this round of Champions League negotiations, there was a piece in the FT which suited the clubs down to the ground a bit. Wanda wanted to create its own Super League, and in a way, you know, we because we've had all these structures, we've had FIFA and the clubs and UEFA, we kind of believe that it's always going to be here forever because that's all we know. But there's kind of no reason why it has to be this way. Tradition is another big part of what the problem could be. We can get onto that in a sec. But, you know, just, you know, your club team is your club team. Do you care if it's in the Wanda sponsored Europa Champions League or in the UEFA Champions League? You just want to see your teams play each other potentially. My worry on the Chinese investment, football clubs, you know, the genie's out now, isn't it? I mean, anyone could buy it. We had this here last 10, 15 years, Russians, Americans, etc., buying the clubs, and we had the anti-Glazer stuff at Manchester United, etc. So why shouldn't China just... It's the same, effectively. But the speed and scale of everything being hoovered up, you know, in the last 12 months, we haven't got enough time to tot everything up. We'll be here till tomorrow. I mean, it's just been so much so quickly that I can't imagine all of this being successful. So you could see some historic clubs just fall by the wayside or have serious problems. I don't know if this is going to happen, but the AC Milan deal, for example, just seems bonkers. Mm. This price is huge, and they keep changing the dynamic of who's actually buying AC Milan to the point is no one really knows. It's some guy in China and his mates. And he seems to have fallen out with that guy, and the other guy's come in now, and the deadline's moved. You know, and AC Milan is like football royalty. It's being treated like this very strange piece of flesh that a few guys, you know, thousands of miles away are sort of biting over.
I just gotta say, I'd take issue with the suggestion that it's the same as the investment from Abramovich and Abu Dhabi and American owners in recent times. I think this is part of something bigger and something wider. This is more of a project.
It's definitely part of a national project, but I think, you know, there are enough wealthy individual Chinese people to do some of this stuff. You know, the state aspect is obviously there. It's China, and Xi unleashed this thing that we're seeing. But you know, I don't know Roman Abramovich personally, but it probably isn't bad cover to get to own a very famous English football team and live in London, when at that period of time it was quite tough to be an oligarch. I mean, his sponsor is now dead. You know, Boris Berezovsky, for example, who launched Abramovich into the world, is fell out with Putin and is no longer here. So being in Britain does give you that sort of cachet and that cover as well as a sort of legitimate businessman.
Yeah. Wanda, of course, also sponsor of FIFA now, who have a new president. Got a new president this year. Remember when that felt like a big deal? Anyway, do we think there's going to be a kind of competing, you know, a counter effect of a stimulation at the grassroots of people maybe saying, well, elite sport has changed and I'm less interested in it now. And we'll see a kind of an acceleration of the AFC Wimbledons and such like. Or are people just gonna watch the best stuff?
I don't know what people... I don't know people. I worry if I'm in charge of a sort of sports governing body who isn't in the absolute top flight, I am worried at the moment because it's almost a sort of existential threat that is being posed in terms of, well, why do you exist? What is it that you do? You know, if you're looking at running, we're sitting here and sport at the grassroots is booming in various places and lots of people doing stuff, from trampolining to running and, you know, whatever. But how much of it is driven by the national governing bodies and what their role is in this is quite a tricky one. And, you know, so if you look at Park Run, you look at CrossFit, you look at, you know, the sort of sports that are blossoming outside of the what we might call the official sport governing body route. As money, and there is a sort of, there is no appetite for state-funded sport at the moment and in many countries. I think if you're sort of a national governing body or even a, you know, a sports governing body, of which there are many, you're going to have to start proving your position or, you know, establishing what it is that you do. And I'm not saying for a minute that I don't think that these people don't add value, but there's going to be some hard questions.
Okay, we'll leave it there for part one, but we'll be back with you in just a jingle. Welcome back to the Sports Pro Podcast. It's Christmas time, and Christmas is about bringing together people who've been away and all of that stuff. And it's in that spirit that we bring to you for the first time on the Sports Pro Podcast via direct link from Canada to the White Swan Shepherd Neame in Aldgate East. Sports Pro America's editor, Michael Long. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm very well, Owen. Thanks for having me.
So, Canada, snowy, Christmassy, all that good stuff?
Yeah, of course. Perfect ski conditions.
You've wisely, in retrospect, chosen to base yourself in Canada rather than south of the border. There's no real getting away from the fact that the big story, the big all-encompassing everything story in North America in the last 12 months has been golf mogul turned autocrat Donald Trump. What's the mood, as you can discern it, within the North American sports industry and particularly, I guess, the major leagues about Donald Trump?
Sure. Most of the people I've spoken to are, pretty unwilling to talk too much about it and speculate on what his, you know, his election might mean for their league and for their sport and for the sports industry in general. One thing we can say is that it certainly detracted from the sporting action this year. You can tie in, I suppose, the NFL ratings dip, for example, was probably one kind of knock-on effect of the round-the-clock coverage the election kind of received. But in terms of the mood, I can imagine it's very similar to what it's like there in the UK after Brexit. You know, it's plainly apparent that there's clear divisions across kind of US society. And you know, it's really quite depressing. I was in Portland when shortly after the election, actually, and there were riots going on and things, and it's a difficult time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that we're starting to see culturally how different these leagues are, and because it's been such a divisive period in American politics, and you know, even by the standards of American politics in the last 20 years. You're seeing perhaps the NBA skew a slightly different way from the NFL, for example. Already people talking about not staying in Trump hotels and things of that nature.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's perhaps illustrative of the kind of history of the game, their kind of core fan bases, perhaps. I don't know. But, you know, the NBA is certainly a league that has historically kind of taken a stand on political issues and things like that. I know, obviously, this year, for example, Adam Silver attempted to come to some kind of workaround for the All-Star Game in Charlotte next year, but couldn't come to any kind of agreement on that. So ultimately pulled it out of there due to North Carolina's discriminatory bill concerning the LGBT community. You know, they're walking a tightrope, I guess. The leagues, you know, don't want to upset anyone, but they've also got to assert themselves and take a stand on certain issues. And the NBA is very much at the forefront of that, I think.
We also had the NFL issue related to the Black Lives Matters group. I don't know what's happening with that. I don't know, but it was quite prominently displayed around the world. Some of the world's best athletes, best paid athletes, sort of in a fight with their own league. I don't know what does that look like now?
Yeah, I'm not sure where that's at. I know it's certainly not as prominent as it was, you know, early in the season when Colin Kaepernick was taking a stand, and he opened up a bit of a chasm between not only the certain players in the league, but U.S. society in general. It's difficult to know, I guess, most of the time what people are really thinking on these issues.
It's the old sport and politics maxim, but it's the intrusion of political life into an area that had been, in the US, in those terms, had been very commercial. And you look at the attempted expansion of the NFL into other markets, of the NBA into other markets. These are things that I suppose will have an impact on those ambitions. Perhaps more directly political is the LA 2024 Olympic bid. Have you got much of a sense of them losing step on that at all, or do you think they've managed to react to an unexpected commander-in-chief with the kind of professionalism you might expect out of that operation?
Yeah, so Trump has, said he supports the bid. The bid has kind of welcomed that support. Obviously, it's got to play its cards right in the political sense. I don't think anyone really knows, and I'm not sure personally whether it will. His election will work for or against, you know, specifically against the bid.
I was actually wanted to ask Mike a question on those lines. Does Trump want the Olympics in LA? Because we've heard a lot of stories that if Le Pen wins in France next year, she's just going to come out and say no Olympics in Paris. It's not what we want. Is it something that Trump will look to follow through on, or is he just going to can the whole idea?
No, I think he supports it to some degree, from what I understand.
Donald Trump loves gold. This is the thing that we need to bear in mind.
The thing with Trump, and it's kind of weird. It's really weird. Donald Trump, you know, how many times are you going to say Donald Trump's the president of America? It's just odd, right? And that was the issue in the summer, like when the Olympics were on and you had LA 2024 pitching up in Brazil and talking to everyone about how good their bid was. You've got to think Casey Wasserman, massive contributor to Hillary's campaign, big Democratic mayor Eric Garcetti in LA. They took any opportunity and every opportunity to disparage Donald Trump, and said, you know, it would be a blow at the time to their bid. And you know, if you are a fundraiser, it just seems so. Even though he was in the race, it seems so outlandish that he's going to be the president of America that they felt comfortable that they could really do him down. And then, honestly, to be a fly on the wall in that campaign room, despite, you know, their professionalism, what they've said afterwards and the phone calls they've had between Team Trump and LA 2024, what it would have been like in their room, would have been really interesting to hear those conversations.
I mean, the other, you mentioned Casey Wesserman, the other interesting figure in this is Ari Emanuel, because he was Trump's agent, essentially, whilst also being the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who was the Secretary of State under the Obama, Chief of Staff. In the first administration. So, you know, it's an odd one. And also, I've done a bit around Trump and golf. Nothing explains Trump better than golf and his behaviour in the way in which he sort of looks at the golf business. And, you know, it's once you sort of have seen him in that environment, then it all makes sense. You can sort of see all of the sort of political campaigning that he did was a version of what he's done in golf for the last 15, 20 years. So.
Let's try and move away from that as much as we can. I mean, there have been some real highlights in US sport this year. Chicago Cubs was an extraordinary story, literally a once-in-a-lifetime story. You know, the NBA Finals as well generated an enormous amount of interest around the world and delivered just the most extraordinary climax. But what are the stories going to be going into 2017 for American sport, Mike?
Yeah, I think, both of those leagues, MLB, NBA, coming off the back of record-breaking seasons, breaking ratings for their finals, and seeing a surge in revenues and interest internationally and at home. You know, they both recently agreed CBAs that will continue their labor peace for several years to come. Clearly, they're both kind of unified, and both sides of the negotiating table in both leagues know that, you know, it would just be plainly absurd if they were to descend back into any kind of work stoppage at this point, with the overall picture looking so rosy. Heading into next year, both leagues, you know, it's very much kind of business as usual. I think for the NHL, it's still in limbo over the issue of whether their players will participate at Pyeongchang. So that will be obviously a story that continues into the new year. You know, the NFL still doing what the NFL is does so well. It is a behemoth within US sports, and you know, but there's still lingering uncertainty over the kind of future of the San Diego Chargers and the Oakland Raiders on the West Coast. Will they stay? Will they go? We should find out in the new year what the Chargers decide to do. And if they decide to stay put and make a go of it in San Diego, then it's on to the Oakland Raiders, and that will continue through 2017. Do they go to Vegas? Do they stay put? Do they go to LA? And the NFL's ratings are kind of rebounding this season, so heading into the postseason, I think it's going to confirm its kind of status as kind of the big one heading into the Super Bowl. And then increasingly, I think when you talk about the major leagues, you've got to factor in MLS into the equation. You know, you saw recently with their playoffs and their finals and the crowds they drew. And I know obviously based here in Canada, there was a Canadian team for the first time in the finals, but the buzz was impossible to ignore heading into that game. I met some guys from the Seattle team back in May, from the Sounders, who went on to win. That was during the Copa America, but the buzz around that city and the way that soccer is kind of embraced there. I can't speak for other cities in the US, perhaps Tarek can, but I think soccer has its place. It has arrived, and we'll see where that goes in the years to come.
All right, cheers, Mike. We'll leave you to get on with your day, and Merry Christmas.
And to you all.
Enjoying this Sports Pro podcast? Well, we're also the sports industry leader in print, digital, and events. Head to sportspromedia.com for the latest features, news, and interviews from the business of sport. Help yourself to a subscription to our acclaimed magazine and find out about our unmissable conferences before anyone else. Get inside the industry with Sports Pro.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Sports Pro podcast and the final bit of Sports Pro podcasting in 2016. It is metaphorically December the 31st, and everyone is kind of splayed out on the sofa. They've eaten way too much, they've drunk way too much, and they are thinking, never again. And it's in that spirit that we are going to delve into everybody's sports industry New Year's resolutions for 2017, if we get that far. Adam Nelson, is there anything that you would be particularly keen to see happen next year?
Particularly keen to see happen? Well, I was going to bring this back around to the Olympic discussion from part one and look forward to the decision over where the 2024 Olympics are going to take place. You were talking about... sorry, it was Richard, wasn't it? He was talking about how the Olympics still has that benefit of providing a kind of infrastructural impetus to cities. But I think that the problem with that is that the only cities that can now afford to bid for the Olympics are ones that already have that kind of infrastructural setup in place. So, you know, Paris and LA, while would benefit from having some infrastructure investment, have already got all that. It's not like going to Rio or Beijing, where these cities really need that, and they need that deadline, and they need that kind of impetus that Olympics provide. I think it's strange that we're now in a situation where, you know, Budapest is a proper rank outsider. There's very little chance of that happening. So the two competitors, and it's been the case in the past few Olympic races, although it has happened to go to Rio for the previous one, where it's cities that you look at and you think, do they need the Olympics, or is it just another showpiece for what is already an incredible world city? So I'm backing Budapest. That's what I'd like to see happen in 2017. I'd like to see Budapest get 2024 Olympics.
Okay.
It's my resolution to award that to Budapest.
Tarek?
What I'd like to see in terms of next year or even further on is like some sort of paradigm shift in what these events look like. Do they need to be that big? And also, you know, architects are very good. Got these very clever engineers, etc. Maybe something with modular stadiums. You know, for example, you take 37 sports. I don't know how many sports are going to be in the next games, but you know, most host countries don't favour that many sports. The domestic market isn't built for some of these things. For example, cycling or velodromes, etc. Don't really translate in Brazil. Neither does golf, for example. Not really a modular sport, but you could just try and build this stuff for these events and then move on. And then the IOC, perhaps, and its sponsors could bear a burden of some of that. And then you get quite a lot of goodwill, maybe, from that for sport as well. Yeah. We won't be talking about some of this ugly stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was brought home, really, in Brazil. They really bought into their own sports, but not everything else. In the way, you know, London had been about, let's muck in, let's go watch handball, let's go watch, you know, synchronized swimming. And not every country has that kind of joining in culture. I mean, this is the last gasp, really, isn't it, for this model? Not the last gasp, but maybe the last chance for this model. And there's talk of maybe the runner-up in 2024 getting 2028. So you have two safe choices, one after the other. But I heard some much more radical solutions, even, you know, the idea of a global Olympics where you have everything taking place over a two-week period, but you tie it to cities and to cultures where those particular sports are big, and then you have the advantage of hitting every time zone with television. Yeah.
Yeah. The problem then is it's hard to see where that differs from what they're doing in, is it 2018 with the European Championships, where all the European Championships are being held at the same time. Mm. Does it become an Olympic Games, or is it just a lot of different World Championships?
But then, if the Olympic Games is a television event, then that's one way of approaching it. And, of course, the alternative is it just goes to Athens and it stays there.
Yeah. I think what Tarek was saying there is a large part of my point. It's not that long since Atlanta had the Olympic Games. Before that, it wasn't so long since Munich. These aren't huge global cities, even on the scale of Beijing or Rio. I kind of wonder why it has to be that now. I mean, it's obviously because the Olympics has got so out of hand, it's become this enormous beast that it takes a city on that scale to host it. I'd like to see it pared down a little bit, and I'd like to see it able to go to more diverse places that you perhaps wouldn't expect.
Mm. Yeah, so Hillary Clinton had It Takes a Village, and Adam Nelson has It Takes a City on that scale. Richard Gillis, any New Year's resolutions?
So, resolutions, I think I'm not going to read anything more about FanDuel or DraftKings about things I give absolutely no tosses whatsoever. Esports is up there as well. Drone racing is not something I'm going to take enormous sort of interesting. Drone racing, you know, I think that's probably a sign of something. I thought that and Oscar going to China at the age of 25, I thought they're two of the most depressing sort of stories I've ever, of the last year. The Infantino World Cup plan, you know, this sort of groups of three thing, I think, you know, just talking about the Olympics and innovation in event structures, some of the, and Tarek mentioned this earlier, about, you know, the stuff that we've grown up with doesn't necessarily need to be the same going forward. And I think that's actually true of the structure of it. I don't know what's going to happen there, and you probably might have more of a view on that, but it was sort of so odd that I couldn't quite compute what he was talking about and why he was doing it, but there must be, you know, something there.
I think this raises the point of what you said earlier about the reasons to be for governing bodies. Now, FIFA and other UEFA and all these bodies, they're regulators, licensors, event holders, etc. All these competing roles where, you know, as far as Infantino's concerned, if you really were to sort of lock him in a room and say, best World Cup, yeah, 32 teams, four teams in each group. What, just like it is now? Yeah, of course. You know, but he went round the world trying to get elected, and he's telling everyone that, you know what, if you vote for me, I'll give you a bit more cash, and you probably might get you in the World Cup as well, so we're going to make that really big. But won't that ruin it? Yeah, we won't talk about that now, but you might get to the World Cup, Bahamas, or whoever, or India, or Bangladesh, or whatever.
Scotland.
Scotland. of course.
Sorry, that was a bit cheers.
You know, this is where we are. You then have to deliver. And is it going to ruin the product a bit? Kind of, yeah, right? I mean, well, let's see. Let's see if this crazy, you know... His first idea was to basically have 16 seeded teams. Mm. Then have 32 other teams, or playing once. Could be Australia flying to the US or wherever, playing one game, getting knocked out and going back, and half of those teams would play one game in a World Cup. That was kind of lampooned in the media, and that's what he's been doing. He's been flying these kites, and now we've got this new thing of groups up to the letter P. I don't think we've seen any sport where we've got to be P yet, where you can have this three-group thing and then a knockout. And then, you know, TV companies, perhaps they want more games, more live. Yeah. I don't know.
I guess the only limits in that case to tournament expansion are alphabetical. but, yeah, I do feel like there's a supply and demand issue that's wider in sport, and I guess this would be mine, would be to try and get back in check the idea of how much sport people want to watch and how big things need to be, and it becoming about things being at the elite level, being premium, rather than being plentiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of, you know, huge oversupply of sport generally, and premium is all about sort of restricting and creating scarcity, whereas the money coming into sport is driving demand, you know, so increasing supply of sport, and there is only so much, and there are only so many premium events.
The other interesting thing to look at again next year and then years hence is going to be TV, right? We sort of touched upon Sky, etc. The model, this linear model,
OTT,
and God knows what else is going to be around the corner. There's all sorts of new entrants and streaming and everything else. Now, you know, we can ask around this table, do you watch TV the same way, even sport the same way you did 5 years ago? Personally, absolutely not. I think I watch a lot less and in different ways. Plus, the information we're getting through social media, etc., you kind of immersed in a game without seeing it on TV.
It's the old test match experience, isn't it? Of you can't watch most of it, so you're just going to follow it but not watch it.
Yeah, people are still engaged, even more so perhaps because you've got all the other devices, etc. In sport, what does that mean for a linear broadcaster like Sky? It's really interesting. We've done a few stories at Bloomberg on Sky and its sport products. One thing they haven't revealed to anyone, these numbers for their side set-top box thing, this Now TV product.
Yeah, which I've got. It's great.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You use that thing.
I've cut the cord.
There we go. We've got live cord cutting.
I'm a cord-cutting millennial.
So what will that mean? The picture of a cord-cutting millennial.
Exactly,
right?
I am exactly the target market for that.
What does it mean?
I don't understand why I would ever go back to a sort of full package or you know.
Yeah.
It has completely changed. They've had to do it because obviously everyone was, you know, leaving anyway. But I think that hovering over this whole conversation is, you know, the end point of Amazon, Apple entering the rights market in a substantive way. It feels perfect. You know, if you had global worldwide rights to the Premier League and the only place you could get them was, you know, via Amazon Prime, it would, at a stroke, change the marketplace. And, you know, they've got enormous amounts of money to spend, as have Apple. So we're looking this year, you know, everyone got excited about Twitter's deal with the NFL, and, you know, it was an interesting bargaining thing there between Yahoo and Twitter, and it was... That feels like a stalking horse. That feels like sort of early stages, and actually there's going to be a major investment. They've always denied they're going to get involved, and you know, and you talk to I remember talking to Adam Silver at the NBA, and he said, yeah, they want to get involved.
Amazon are at the table.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, from recent
they've
stories,
appointed a head of sport. We don't know quite what he's doing yet, but we know he's going to be doing something.
Well, I think what we might be seeing will be that'll be interesting next year. Is from what I heard, a lot of tennis, among other sports, tennis is something they've got an eye on, and there's a lot of tennis around, so you can dip your toe into it and see how it works. And improve and iterate your product.
It's a good sport as well because it's properly global. Like it's one of the few sports that is equally followed in various different territories. It doesn't have that kind of geographic specificity that a lot of sports do.
And
basically, it means America gets it, doesn't it? It's always tennis and golf are the two, aren't they? America, they get those two and their own sports.
Well, the other thing with Amazon, which is like, what is the core business of Amazon that we know is buying stuff, right?
Yeah.
So. Again, it wouldn't be too much of a leap to think about, you know, if you are watching tennis, that these people know everything about you these days, which is terrifying. You know, this guy likes tennis and be pumping products off one part of their business into the other. You know, it's basically, you know, we're going to a different world.
Yeah, and they've started prepping that now in a small way with some of the partnerships they're doing with teams at venues where Amazon will have designated drop-off areas for Amazon, was it Amazon Prime Now? Whatever it was that Adam Nelson got his Secret Santa from the other day. Where you'll be able to say, you're at a tailgate party, we've run out of ketchup, and it's on the way. And I suppose it'll be the same thing, it'll be targeted. You've got people watching the game live. Hey, do you want something to watch the game live with? It is entering that space, and you do feel like it's a numbers game now. They want to settle on the number, and they want to make sure that they've got the infrastructure there. With a toe dipping exercise,
good
maybe
for, good for sport, I guess, for the owner of property. You got more competitors for your rights. The thing that, again, how do we consume? Do I want 9 different subscriptions though?
Yeah.
Mm. An Amazon here, a Sky, etc. So again, there's gonna be another change. I don't know who's gonna bundle. Someone's gonna have to bundle this in and do that. But at the same time, we've got Murdoch trying to, and it looks like he's going to do it this time, buy all of Sky, which has for years run on, been based in the back of sport, really. Now, if Sky loses, can Sky lose sport? What? You keep watching, will people keep paying? I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? And this next few months will be extremely interesting.
I found it interesting that you said, I'm a cord cutter as well, Richard, but a proper millennial, not just a pretend one. And I found it interesting that you said that you now watch less sport despite having these different ways to do it. I certainly watch a lot more because it's, you know, I have my iPad and it's got Sky Go
you
thing
you
on it.
It's all esports, though, isn't it? You do
sort of, yeah, Twitch, all the Star Wars, whatever. No, that's not. That's the film.
That's,
isn't it?
That's
you've given yourself away.
I've given myself away. But I find that it's much easier to just drop into a sport that I might not otherwise. So the other night I got back from the pub and I just flicked on the NBA. And normally I wouldn't be awake when the NBA is going on, but I happened to be when I wanted to watch sport and it was so accessible. It was just there. So I find that it has changed the way that I watch sport, definitely, but it means that I watch a lot more now than I used to.
Different sports.
You find yourself engaging in a wider range but a shallower level, you know. So I know, you know, it's sort of... And my favourite conspiracy theory of the year is the closure of Vine and Twitter closing Vine due to its sort of ambitions with sports rights holders. I have no idea whether it's true. I just think it sort of... Because Vine is absolutely the perfect sports... the vehicle for sports highlights, you know. And I was getting to the stage where I wasn't needing to watch Match of the Day because I was watching Vine, you know, on Twitter live. And that leak is incredibly dangerous for the rights holders, but fantastic for...
That's where it's going, and it's been interesting, and maybe we're taking ourselves back a step because we're talking about subscription broadcasters and so on. But Sky Sports has almost gone out to undercut BT by showing clips of games, I think, during BT games, which is quite a strategy. And also we've seen the ICC and we've seen ECB in the past year make quite good progress with clip rights. To the BBC, for example.
I mean, people like the European Tour do it fantastically well. Yeah. You know, but I do wonder about the commercial wisdom of it. You know, and this sort of, we've again grown up with this.
Well, everyone.
You have to put a wall around it, and it has to be impenetrable because otherwise you won't pay.
And I think the big elephant in the room, and they don't like talking about it. No one likes talking about it this much. Is piracy is really good these days.
Yeah.
And if Sky don't put the clips on, there'll be some dude in his bedroom who's going to put the clip on anyway. Yeah. So that's the real big challenge now.
I think we're moving towards, as well, sports properties having to think of themselves as an experience.
Mm, exactly. That something has to be higher. Right?
And something that you're living with all the time, rather than here is a televised product that we sell and they package up and they distribute.
Yeah.
Particularly for longer form stuff, and I don't just mean a golf tournament or a cricket match or whatever. I mean over the course of a season. In an NBA season, not many people are going to watch every game in an NBA season or an NHL season because there's dozens and dozens of games. But they might want to keep following their team and see how somebody's doing. I suppose the other thing that this is all going to lead towards is a change in the in-venue experience, the in-venue targeting. Maybe we'll start having more, particularly at newer stadiums, more of a tiered experience.
Like the music industry, basically. Yeah. Like, I think that's the only precedent I can think of that was, use a word that people are using, disrupted. Mm. Well, music was the first one to get the full force of the internet when people were stealing music to the point where the industry almost collapsed, right? Now, a lot of the rebirth has been around what you say, these experiences. Live has become much more premium, and they're focused on making that experience better and maybe cashing in through that.
I mean, there's the premium thing, but then there's also using the income that Elite Sport has from broadcasting and from other sources, whether it's, you know, Chinese investment or whatever else we've talked about, to bring people in at a more reasonable entry point. You know, whether that's cheap ticketing or free ticketing or whatever, just filling grounds up, and lots of sports are going to have to find a way of meeting that, even at the very top.
It's really hard. It's a really hard one, that, because psychologically, free ticketing really devalues the product, and they've sort of a few. But I always say that, you know, that if I was a sponsor, I really don't get why sponsors just don't get in front of this issue. You know, if I'm a football club sponsor, why do I not just spend my money on bringing ticket prices down? You'd be a hero. You know, sponsors are a necessary evil. They're perceived as sort of just part of the corporatization of sport, when actually they could really help. And I really don't get it. And there's obviously something structural going on. There's something to do with the clubs won't let them or whatever. But actually, if I'm a team sponsor, if I'm on the shirt, I want to be the fan's hero. Then the best way to that is to lower ticket prices, lowering the cost of the people who actually go to the ground. You know, the loyal hardcore is just a wide open goal. You know, without,
and the Premier League in England, the TV rights contract is out of this world.
Yeah,
they could all give, especially say you start with away tickets, for example. I don't know. You could give. Of all of them away, and it really wouldn't affect bottom line.
Well, they have moved towards 30s plenty, which doesn't quite rhyme as nice as the 20s plenty campaign, but they have made steps in that direction. But obviously, much more needs to be done.
The issue, I guess, is it's a competition, and even if you have £1 more in the transfer market than the other team, that's what we're kind of finding,
all the pieces have to fit together. Something we've not discussed just yet. Big story this year is doping. I don't want to go into too much depth about that, but how much are these issues really affecting people's engagement with sport? People talk about athletics as having been decimated by the doping question. Is it that, or is it that athletics is a very 1980s television product? We've just been talking about television products and, it's a set-piece TV affair, and maybe that's got as much to do with it as anything else, and this is all just part of the story. I mean, how existential is the threat, I guess, of doping to the whole affair?
But both, isn't it, really? I mean, there's no reason why athletics still needs to look like it did in the 1980s. People have been lazy, probably, and they're just doing it the same way. Just talked about Ultimate Fighting or UFC or whatever. These guys have reinvented something. You just need to have a bit of imagination. Olympics are special events, obviously, but... No, there's no better night at the games than a big track and field meet during the Olympics. And these guys are superstars, and they
I'm going to see it here next year as well, of course.
Yeah, absolutely, and we're going to see the buzz in the papers, etc. We've got to create stories around these people, like a year-round narrative and everything else. But in terms of the doping, I think more for track and field, it's been horrific from a sponsor's point of view. With Adidas, which started. Sports sponsorship has always been with them, and they've walked out. Nestle walked out, and that's a surefire sign that it is having maybe not an existential threat, but a serious threat to the IAAF for sure. I mean, what do you reckon, Richard?
Well, there's sort of the drugs thing has been there for a long time. It is really, really damaging. However, it's sort of... We still get excited about Olympics. Now, I'm not sure. I mean, this is a sort of parochial view. The sort of... The news of the how London 2012 now looks in the rearview mirror through the lens of the sort of doping scandal and how many of the stuff that we looked at... I said earlier that the Olympics, the sport always saves the sports business, in terms of the way in which it's seen. Doping is so fundamental, so difficult, and to sort of counter what you're seeing. And if what we're seeing isn't true, that really, really is dangerous. And having said that, cycling has never been more popular. And, I remember... talking about cycling and doping 15 years ago, Festina and all that stuff. So it's quite a sort of... It's an odd one. It feels like it should be incredibly... It should be decimated, but actually the sports are stronger than that.
Is that because... do you think the flag trumps all, though? Do you think cycling's big here because Brits are really good at it all of a sudden, so we got this, right? Or the Olympics, we don't... Come on, if we're really honest, I mean, there's... 70-80% of sports no one really cares about apart from during the Olympics.
I also think there's a huge participation element to cycling, that people are getting involved actively in cycling and then they want to follow the sport as well to see the elite side of it, whereas no one is taking up the 100 metres. No one is taking up other sports that have had these doping allegations against them. Cycling is slightly in a different world.
People are taking up distance running, but I take your point. There is a lifestyle element to cycling. Right, let's all start to feel a little bit better just before we wrap up.
So death.
Oh, good.
Arnold Palmer, Arlie Cruyff. Has there been a worst loss?
It's very much in keeping with the tenor of 2016 public figure death, isn't it? It's unique, iconoclastic figures. You know, the Bowies and the
Prince
and the Leonard Cohens and the Princes and
A.A. Gill.
Yeah.
I know.
The people, the irreplaceable. Just keep the moods.
So I think one of the best things I've seen is Tarek's beard, first of all.
No, thank you.
It's the first time I've seen it. There's an element. He's gone from looking 14. He now looks, you know, his normal age, and I'm all in favour of this.
Man,
bring it on. I want it longer. I want a massive, great, big Brian Blessed beard by this time next year.
I sound like Brian Blessed this time next year, don't I?
The other bit I'm looking forward to is I thought this year one of the stories was women and women's sport. I thought there was a few interesting TV and sponsorship deals around football mainly. I think next year you've got Women's World Cup in the UK, I think is a big moment. They will fill out Lords, which I think is going to be quite a significant moment. You know, so and I think we start to think about women's sport in a different way and in the way in terms of its marketing. So I think that's a sort of real, commercially, that's a real sort of white space because there aren't many people in it and it's relatively cheap, and that's always been the sort of the thinking. But I think now actually the profile is going up and we're starting to see that in a genuine traction.
On TV as well, Richard?
Yeah, well, maybe. But it's maybe, as we've said, maybe it doesn't need TV. Maybe it doesn't, you know, the sort of barrier of the sort of linear television model with then sponsors jumping on board, maybe actually women's sport will benefit more from a sort of long-tail, social-led approach rather than the sort of interesting TV rights.
It's also, I guess, an opportunity from an industry standpoint to start from scratch in a way that, you know, more established sporting properties can't do. And starting from scratch is what we will be doing in just a couple of weeks' time. But we're going to end the Sports Pro Christmas special there. Thank you very much, Adam Nelson.
Thank you, Owen, and Merry Christmas, everyone, once again.
Thank you, Tarek Panja.
Nice to be here, first time. Hopefully join you again at some point, maybe this time next year, with a bigger beard.
Bring it.
And thank you, Richard Gillis.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
And Merry Christmas, and thanks for listening in 2016. We will speak to you again in 2017. Bye-bye.